Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 19, where we revisit the works of the Carnegie Mellon School of Management, an endeavor first started in episode 4, this time focusing on the 1991 work called Exploration and Exploitation in Organizational Learning by James March. To find out more about the series in general and this episode in particular, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, joining in from Brighton in the United Kingdom.
My name is Miranda, joining you from Leamington Spa in the UK.
And my name is Ralph, joining you from 1,600 meters above sea level in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
It's always a fun fact when Ralph was joining in.
Yes, I try to add new things whenever I can.
Yes, I keep forgetting to do the same, but maybe next time. Right, so this is a very significant paper that, at least in my experience, turned out nothing like what I thought it was going to be. Because as is the case with many of the classics that we read, I haven't actually read this previously, which is a bit shocking given that my area of specialization is basically this. So in this work, March argues that he's essentially tackling this this problem that whether you invest in developing and exploring new knowledge or whether you focus on perfecting what you already know and implementing that into practice better. So he argues that firms focusing too much on exploration, which is finding the new stuff out, may suffer the costs of experimentation but not gain any of the benefits that basically would come because the ideas would be underdeveloped. So think of essentially always finding out new stuff but not really putting it into practice. March argues that the firms may then become locked into a vicious failure trap where failure leads to search and change, which leads to more failure. But on the other hand, the exploiters, the exploitation aspect, is beneficial in the short term because you gain efficiency and you go up the learning curve and use fewer resources to do the things that you know how to do. But it's catastrophic in the long run because firms get stuck in what is called a competence trap. And the competence trap is basically doing the same thing over and over again with no regard for anything that's going on around you. Dilemma there is that because of the knowledge exploration's greater uncertainty and also further being removed in time and space from the organization, most companies would focus on more on exploitation, so doing the things they know how to do, rather than on exploration. And what March kind of grapples with is what is the balance between exploration and exploitation, basically how much of which you would want to do as a manager, as an organization in order to become and keep being sustainable in the long run. So how much of finite resources to invest in finding new stuff out versus how much to invest in making it work. And that's kind of the basic, I think, summary of this paper. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that was good. I think that's basically what the article is about.
Yeah, I think it covered the main points.
Well, I guess in the case with myself, it was a bit hard going because, as I mentioned before, that I didn't expect it quite to be like this. And it turns out that the paper, it's written for, published by Organization Science Journal, which is quite quantitative and hard data driven, so to speak. And it's a model, essentially. The paper is not an empirical study of companies doing exploration and exploitation. It's a mathematical thought experiment.
That's what I noticed as well. And my practitioner background, as well as my interest in qualitative evidence, or I guess empirical work, what made it such that I was not very satisfied by the conclusions that he draws. I mean, I think there's some general assessments that you can make about exploitation versus exploration, but he admits early on that the model is very simple. So I don't want to get too negative at the beginning of the podcast, but that's one thing that I found I struggled with a great deal was he would make statements in the article it's been shown that, or previous work has shown, and doesn't actually cite the previous work when he makes some of those statements. Sometimes he does, but so some challenges with my understanding of how you would actually be able to use this information, but it's a very well-known work and very widely cited. I looked at the citations and it was tens of thousands, so very influential, certainly.
I share I'm a bit skeptical about the article, let's put it that way. I didn't find it so appealing, if I can say that. Mostly because I didn't expect, I had the sense of reading a model from economics. So
yes, oh, that's a great way to say it. I had the same thought.
A vision of the world that is simplified, because that is the purpose of these kind of models. Abstract, but not satisfying for my taste, let's put it that way. So that was one thing that kind of, it's not my cup of tea, let's put it that way. I think that is the most correct statement I can throw out there. So that was one thing. On the other, I don't know, this idea of exploitation, exploration, and being simplified, I think there's much more that can be said. Because from as I saw it from the beginning, exploitation or exploration can actually be related to this idea of going towards the unknown. So having all this, these risks that you're facing, and exploitation is kind of staying safe. And I think there could be much more that can be said. What's behind that? Why should we choose one or the other? How can it apply even to routines or practices, not just products and strategies? When is it right to do one or the other? I think it's a world which is extremely rich and can be opened up even further.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I try to sort of resist this initial being turned off by how economic it is on such a social topic. But when I did get into it, I faced another issue, is mainly all the assumptions on which this model is based.
Oh,
and I identified some of them. I can't really subscribe to any of them. So the ones that it's of course a subjective position, although it is based on many years of study and some years of research into this. But, you know, we see the world through the lens that we see it through. I think it's fair enough. One of the main things here that I think is guiding this entire paper is that it is very manager oriented. So it assumes a situation where a manager has to decide on behalf of the organization whether to engage in this abstract exploration or exploitation. And from that perspective, the terminology makes sense as an exercise in resource allocation. Some of the other ones that the four assumptions that I identified, which I think, I mean, you may not agree with me, but kind of for the benefit and hopefully not to confuse the readers, listeners, this may help kind of to understand where this is going. And before I list the four, I think it's also important to highlight what Miranda said, that this paper is more significant in all the discussion that it's generated rather than, I think, in its actual direct contributions to the body of knowledge.
Yeah, so that's maybe right about that.
So the four assumptions that I found is, one is that the environment is more or less stable. Second was that knowledge is also stable, not static, but stable. Third is that knowledge is manageable. And fourth is that knowledge is stored within and by the organization. And the last one in particular is came very close to heart, because that's basically claims on organizational memory, which is my direct area of expertise.
Right.
I don't know if we want to go into all four of them or whether you agree, but these are not listed explicitly. So these are what I distilled from the paper. And I find little support in contemporary research as well as own experience and study for any of these.
Can I add something? So the paper was written in 1991 and published in 1991, but this is something that I noticed afterwards. So kind of like my initial thought was that it was a bit older, because given the assumptions, I don't know. I don't know what you felt about this.
Well, the paper actually was received by the journal in 1989.
Okay.
But I don't know, there's been a lot of study that is much, much older that doesn't focus on this sort of almost mechanical understanding of organizations and knowledge in particular. I mean, even stuff we discussed in episode 4 on the routines, where when we read March and Simon 1960s something work organization and Syrett and March a behavioral theory of the firm. Even there, even though it was made to be scientificish, that there were elements that betrayed the more social appreciation that authors had for the organizations. This paper, I think, because it's written for this journal, none of that is there. So it's, to me, it seems almost that they retro-engineered this from a more visceral understanding of exploration and exploitation, to be honest.
I agree. That's a good way to look at it, because you can see many times they're making statements that don't have any basis. They don't refer to the model. They don't refer to the data. They just say, it is clear that, it is clear that. And so I got the sense several times that it was some of the assertions being made were not purely based on the model. It was just this general understanding or heuristics they had for an organization. I do have a couple other assumptions. I don't know how, if they're that important, that I wanted to mention. One is they say in, when he talks about he describes the model on page 74, he says that the different beliefs that an individual has and how they differ from what the beliefs of the organization are assumed to be independent of each other. And no statement for why the independence would exist. And in fact, there's a lot of research that says most people's beliefs about certain things are not completely independent, that they are connected in some ways. And then this other one I thought was interesting was that there's these people that kind of switch their beliefs like a switch. You know, there's an organizational belief and yours is different. It just goes like a switch over to the new thing through a socialization process. And they don't even talk about, so they were talking about how the model is constructed. And they say that the belief switching occurs through socialization, which I, you know, maybe an assumption or just an assertion, but they don't model the socialization. It just, well, that just happens. I get the sense when you look at the, so this isn't really an assumption, just an observation about the model. I get the sense that they're running computer programs with some kind of input that's not really identified that shows how the learning and where equilibrium is achieved. They just, in a prior paper that he wrote with Levitt, I think, they actually make the computer code explicit. Like, here's the code we ran on our model. In this one, they don't even discuss what tests they were on. They just say, well, and here's where, you know, equilibrium is achieved faster this or that way. So an interesting approach to organizational research.
True. But I have much to say about this model. But before
that, yes, I do too.
And none of it, I think, is complementary to the paper. So,
no, I was just going to say, it's not going to be a good thing.
But I think, you know, this is a very important piece of work and certainly sparked a lot of discussion. So maybe, because just listening to us, I don't want to essentially spend an hour and a half saying everything that's wrong with this.
No, I think we can say some other things as well. Yeah, you got to be careful.
So, yeah, so maybe we can start kind of outlining what these things are and why they're important, and then go on to surface our problems with the exact way of communicating them.
That's a good way, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think if we are starting at the beginning, he kind of explains what he means by exploration and exploitation. And by exploration, he means things that are captured by terms such as search, variation, risk-taking, experimentation, play, flexibility, discovery, and innovation. So essentially, a lot of what has to do with trying new things, trying something that hasn't been tried before.
Yeah, I think the common way that we say that now is research and design or research and development. That's often what organizations, these things. He described it very clearly, what he meant by exploration. And that's what I kept thinking about when he was writing, is that there's, and I was thinking sort of technology companies or even industrial organizations, that research or that, you know, search for new ways of doing things is what he's talking about, which I thought was good way to describe that.
I think it might be a bit less structured even than that, because research and development implies some kind of a targeted approach to something to research, but March leaves space for things like play and discovery, which I think also count for accidental stuff, like, you know, the story with the post-it notes, how they were discovered. It was a
I think it depends on how you what you infer from that, but I think any sort of anything unexpected or so. I think what you're talking about or what I understood from this sort of serendipitous action where it wasn't actually a planned like development or product development kind of thing. From what I've read about product development, it can be like what you're talking about, where people kind of experiment with new things or see new ways to do stuff. But I agree, if you're not careful how you talk about it, it sounds like you're trying to produce a particular car or something, as opposed to when Google and Hewlett-Packard and other technology companies would give people time, a certain number percentage of their time during a week to just do whatever they wanted to, whether it was play. And actually, they, and Google, for example, thinks there's a lot of, sorry, I can't really say what they think, but seems to believe that play is an important contributor to creativity, because they've got so many ways, games and ping pong table or table tennis, things that people can do in their off time.
Yeah. So if you're Bruce Banner and you get a dose of gamma radiation, you become the Hulk. That's exploration.
Yes, that's one way to do it.
Doesn't it also refer, like in one section, I think I picked up something along the lines of organizational practices, routines. So I don't know. I sensed it was a general synonym of change to a certain extent.
That's a good. I think that's a good observation. I think that's included too.
Change in
like new processes, or I didn't identify new processes, because he was talking about when the contrast comes up most clearly when he's talking about exploitation and getting better at what you already do, and then he writes an article about how that can close off thinking about new ways to do things. New organizational practices. So it's, I think that's where it comes up. And I think that's a good point.
Sure. My thing was that I think change implies exploited exploration. Whereas Marsh's thing is that a lot of it goes unused. So people find these kind of hints of new things, but because they're not hypothetically adept at exploiting them, that never leads to anything. I mean, it may be semantic, and I think I have a sense of what you're saying, Miranda, but just because change is such a loaded term.
Yeah, true.
It is indeed.
I think it's worth clarifying. And by exploitation, he basically means things like refinement, choice, production, efficiency, selection, implementation, and execution. Basically, most of the stuff we talked about for the past 18 episodes of this podcast.
Right, very, very Tayloristic, yes.
Yeah, so you have a unit of knowledge, if you will, and March will here, and you find out as a manager, as an organization, how to make use of that. So he gives an example of computer technology being used for decision making in organizations, and that you have this machine that maybe, well, in 91, essentially, he's probably talking about personal computers and email and the emergent internet that is there, but no one is quite sure how to use it. So you work out the ways in which these things can be adapted to your organization and how they can be beneficial and in which ways.
This is a good time to observe, since I was in organizations at that time, what the initial use of computers was to speed up things that we were already doing. And there was lots of energy put to taking whatever we were doing manually or with paper and pencil or typewriter, and then just automate that to some extent, the exact same thing we were doing with a computer, as opposed to rethinking how you would do it. And you still see signs of that today. People will take a new technology and they'll just use it to implement the old system in a faster means, as opposed to thinking differently about the system. So I think that's what I saw a lot of in that time frame working.
Definitely. And to me, two things spring to mind that are related to that. One, my girlfriend, Elena, she told me about this history podcast called Hardcore History, which is amazing, by the way. So if you're into that sort of thing, do check it out. It's by Dan Carlin, I think.
Oh, yeah, anyway. I've heard that, yeah.
Oh, you have?
It's brilliant. Quite good, yeah.
It's even longer than ours.
Yeah, it's very long, and he talks all by himself. He doesn't have guests or anything. He just goes on and on, yeah.
But he's brilliant. Anyway.
He is, yeah.
Yeah, and I was listening to the World War One series, where he goes from the antecedents to, well, I haven't finished yet, but I assume it ends at some point. there he talks about when the military leaders were confronted by the trench warfare and how this new, well, it's essentially knowledge. It's a form of structure, of knowledge, sure, of how to organize. How they were confronted with that and were trying to make sense of what to do. So that's the same thing, essentially, the whole email thing that Ralph gave insight into. And I think a contemporary version of that would be the virtual reality that is making its way into organizations, the immersive virtual reality headsets that allow you to either... Well, no one's exactly sure what exactly to do, but one use is for architecture. People are able to virtually go within a blueprint of a building and kind of look around and adjust designs and allocations of services and stuff. And
we do the same thing with ships, actually. And we actually do have that virtual reality tools for that, for ship design.
Yeah, so it's cool. And then there's things like doing meetings instead of teleconferencing or Skyping into to do a podcast. You just go into a virtual space, sit down, or and do that sort of thing. So the point is that it's still being worked out what it is good at, what the technology allows, and how it can be improved. And that is essentially the exploitation aspect that Marsh is talking about.
Right. And in fact, there's many cases of industrial design or new technology where the firm, this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Demetrius, but I think it's related to this. The firm develops some amazing tool, but they struggle to exploit it. And there's this tension between firms that are really good or have some skill at that and then go down the exploitation path. And the example, the classic example that people give is the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, or PARC for short, where they had all these amazing technologies that we now take for granted in computer usage, but they hadn't put into any system or hadn't figured out a way to operationalize. And Steve Jobs got this opportunity to tour the lab one time and came away with all sorts of ideas like the mouse and graphical screen, graphical user interface, those kinds of things. And the other example I was going to quickly give was Hughes, I think it's Hughes Electronics or Hughes Aircraft. They're the ones that are actually credited typically with commercializing or developing the industrial laser, and they never were successful at actually exploiting that. It was other companies that did that.
And if you want to listen from someone who's actually been part of the Palo Alto Research Park, go to episode 12, where we have Paul Duguid, and he actually alludes to some of the stuff that...
That's right.
So, yeah, and basically the reason why James Marsh is writing all this that we just talked about is he is responding, as I think much of the Carnegie Mellon school did, to this hyper-rational view where the problem of exploration and exploitation was viewed in terms of utmost certainty, where it was understood, and he cites a couple of authors, that you have a selection of options that are not entirely known, but the knowledge of which sort of accumulates as you go through, but you need to make a decision as to the allocation of resources. And this paper essentially highlights some of the drawbacks of allocating only to one or to the other, so only to exploration or exploitation, and kind of presents a more, in this weird way, through this mathematical model, a more social, I guess, or socially representative way of viewing the knowledge work. So I think that's kind of the more in-depth version of what this paper is about and why it's so important, because it started the debate on what has become known as ambidexterity, as organizational ambidexterity, where you need to be good at both the exploration and the exploitation, essentially.
So one of the more interesting parts of the paper that I found was when he starts talking about another balance, that maybe it's a second level, it's a level below that of exploration versus exploitation. He's talking about how the learning occurs and rates of learning from newcomers and the socialization process where once newcomers become adapted to the organization body of knowledge, people are able to learn less from them. And I think that's a second dynamic that's going on here that I think goes beyond, as you were saying, this the hyper-rational view of how people learn, how organizational learning occurs.
So just before we go into that, I want to highlight that basically more context to why Marsh is talking about what he's talking about is that there are generally three-ish varieties of this ambidexterity. The first one is structural, which is when you separate exploration and exploitation in different business units. So you have a exploration department and the exploitation department, and that's, I think, not uncommon. So like the R&D department is an archetype of an exploration department, essentially, and the operations department is, you know, the opposite. Second one is sequential ambidexterity, which is when you focus on one and then on the other and then back on the first and kind of vary this way.
So cycling, maybe? Is that what
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cycling is good. And the third one, which is, I think, what Marsh is referring to here, and I think that's the more kind of representative view of reality, is contextual ambidexterity, which is when you kind of simultaneously do both within a single unit. And because it's simultaneously performed, that's why you have this issue of resource allocation.
Yes.
But he never makes it explicit which of these or any other one he's talking about. But I assumed in any case that the problem is because it's kind of all happening roughly at the same time and place within the organization.
And I got the impression that he wasn't trying to actually identify the optimum balance as much as use the model. I mean, what I did think was interesting about the model, because I'm not completely against the idea of using models, what I liked about his use is it gives him the ability to talk about, in a more specific way, some of these trade-offs that are involved and things you have to think about. So from a qualitative social science perspective that I take, I thought that was useful to get, because the model reveals some of those trade-offs and balances and factors. And he does talk about the challenge of allocating resources and intertemporality and changing environments. And so I don't, you know, it didn't seem to me where that he thought the model was actually a full representation of reality, but more of a thought experiment, as it were, but in more concrete terms to highlight some of these issues that managers struggle with.
So I was looking through my notes and I did highlight a lot of like the assumptions that I was a bit doubtful about. And there's one which I'm not sure if this is the moment, but I'll throw it out there and then we'll see what happens. There's something about this assumption or this sentence, reason inhibits foolishness.
Oh, I saw that one.
Learning and imitation inhibit experimentation. And I don't know, maybe it was the choice of words and how it was phrased. It was something that gave me, I don't know, I stopped immediately. And it was something that gave me a lot of food for thought because, yeah, theoretically it is true, but then there is so much more to say. So this idea that reason inhibits foolishness, but again, how can we have progress without a bit of risk taking? So that is one thing. And then...
Well, I think that... Sorry, if yeah. I can just jump in. I think that's the point, because he's talking about how adaptive processes, which is doing something, seeing the results, and then adapting to the result, how they benefit exploitation over exploration in the long term, because that leads to the competency trap, which is when what I mentioned earlier, when you just go and try to get better at doing the same thing and kind of get this trapped in this process. And I think that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, no, I get that, but kind of like the question that came to my mind is if risk taking is something that pushes economic progress and technological advances and so on, how much risk taking do we need? Do we need a lot? Because there is this idea of risk taking being negative. I don't know. It was a question. My question was, where was the line? Where can we draw the line?
Well, we'll find out at the end of the paper, I think. And he's explicit in saying that most of experimentation is going to fail. And it's not going to deliver anything. And much of the risks that organizations will take will not lead to anything of tangible value. And that's kind of the one of the reasons why organizations fall into this competency trap, that they just go for exploration. Sorry.
Exploitation.
Exploitation.
Right.
They go for exploitation in order to safeguard their long-term sustainability. Because if you take fewer risks and expend fewer resources on taking those risks, you waste less stuff.
Right. Or what they perceive as their long-range viability, right? I mean, that's where that kind of gap with reality occurs. But yes, that's what they believe at the time.
Right. And he's saying that, no, actually, if you do that, you're just going to get stuck in your ways and the world is going to move on and leave you behind. And that's why the whole paper is about that actually you need to do quite a bit of exploration if you want to persist. And that leads us to the issue of organizational learning, which is a section that describes the model. And there's a couple of caveats that I didn't notice at first when I was running through this work. He's going to talk about two types of learning in this paper, and they're distinct. So first, he's going to talk about learning between organization and its employees, internal learning.
Right.
And second, he's going to talk about learning between organizations in a competitive environment. There's a lot of confusion, I think, that's associated with doing it that way, but we'll get to that. Importantly, learning is grounded in memory, or what he calls here organizational code. And the reason why I think it's memory is, well, personally, I'm biased towards seeing that everywhere I read.
Right, but that was a good observation, despite your bias.
And he writes that an organization socializes recruits to the language, beliefs, and practices that comprise the organizational code. So, you know, it may as well be, even if it isn't. Then he outlines the model. But basically, the model consists of four elements.
Right.
The first element is that there is an external reality independent of people's beliefs about it. And if that's where we lose you, that's fair enough. That's where he almost lost me as well.
I can accept it. You know, it bothers me, but I can accept it for the purposes of what he's trying to use the model to do, which is identify these larger themes that it helps the model helps identify. So I can live with that. I just recognize that it's artificial, and it would have been nicer if he'd stated it that way, but okay.
I mean, I understood this in a kind of tradition of economic modeling and so on, but I have many, many, many doubts. Like, it doesn't really belong to my way of seeing things, let's put it that way, because detached from people's beliefs, and then you have the idea of people interpreting and seeing the world in a certain way because of their beliefs. So, I don't know. I'm lost here.
Yeah, me too. But let's, I guess, go with it. Because if we're going to discuss this, that will not, you know, that will be a partially examined live podcast.
Okay.
Right. It's illustrative, right? I mean, I try to get too carried away about the distinct conclusions that he draws based on the model. And he makes a lot of general statements based on indications that the model, the way it's set up, shows these trends of where equilibrium is established. So within the confines of the simplicity of the model, I can understand why he set up the way he did. It's because you can't model it. You know, Miranda, I agree with you. I tend to see reality and the social nature of how it's interpreted as much more important than perhaps for the model. But you can't model it. You can't do what he's trying to do with that kind of epistemology.
Yeah. This ontology, even.
Yeah.
Is I mean, not only is reality independent from everything, right? So it has no relation between causality of any kind. It also has dimensions. It has distinct dimensions that have numerical values to them.
In the model that he's designed.
Yeah, it's binary.
Yeah, exactly. I just looked at that and I think, man, that was a head scratcher. But I said, okay, fine, I'll just keep going.
So it's either the dimension is one or minus one. So basically, it's essentially valid or invalid, in relation to nothing at all, because the reality is independent from everything.
Right.
So if you don't get how that works out in the real world, that's fine, because it doesn't work like that. But that is the ontology of this model. And I think it's just, you know, so that we don't go into the metaphysics of reality, I think it's just worth mentioning that someone else who grappled with this issue is Chester Barnard, whom we discussed in episodes 7 and 8.
Yeah.
And he had a different view. So, yeah, please go and listen to those if you haven't yet to see what he had to say. And to a minor extent, we also covered this briefly in episode 16 on Lawrence and Lorsch, who talked about the relationship between the organization and its environment. And also had a broadly similar, although not as strong, attitude towards the reality of things. So maybe it's just a function of time that these works are being written in. I don't know. Anyway. Reality is there, and there's nothing you can do about it, essentially, in this model.
Okay.
But he does say at the beginning, it's a simple model. Okay. It's a simple model.
But I think from this kind of like brief discussion, we've kind of like given the idea that depending on your own ontological and epistemological basis, you can already start off by critiquing the assumptions and therefore not agreeing with kind of like the general work and the conclusions. So it's already something that starts off from way before as a researcher, I mean.
And I think for our listeners, that's something that we encourage, I think we're all encouraging them to do, is try to understand the ontological and epistemological basis of the approach the author's taking. And you may conclude, if it doesn't match your own, that the conclusions aren't valid. But another approach would be to say, all right, let me suspend my concern about the difference from the way the author views reality and the way I do. Just take the conclusions in the context of the assumptions that the author's making, and then see what I think about that. And that's I think what we're encouraging our readers to do, because I think it would be a mistake to take a paper that's been this influential and then dismiss it right at this point because you don't agree with the model set up.
That is 100% correct, because if you don't subscribe to an ontological or even epistemological stance, then you can't engage with the work. It's basically, it's not barking at the right tree,
right,
so to speak. So
and then
yes.
One thing I want to point out, then that closes you off for exploration of new ideas. I just had to say
that's actually an excellent point. Yes, that I guess this is a part of the exploratory process that that is very difficult and not covered in this work whatsoever. Right. But it is covered later on, and we will, I guess, get to that at some point. Anyway, so and the second assumption is that at each time period, beliefs about reality are held by each individual and by the organizational memory, and kind of they have their own validity dimensions, and these can change over time. I got this as so the reality is unchanging and it's there, but both the individuals and the organizations may have true or false beliefs about what that reality is.
Yes, and the only thing I was struggling a little bit with was that he assigns different numerical dimensions to the beliefs. So if you follow the interpretation you had originally of the reality, which I thought was a good one, one is true and negative one is false, however that's determined or defined. I was a little confused about what the zero meant, and I guess what that might mean. I want to test my understanding with you two. That might mean, well, you haven't really decided whether your belief in the is true or false, but you're not really challenging it, or you're taking it for granted, or you really haven't come right out and said you think it's really true or really false, which applies to a lot of things in organizations.
I thought this means no belief. Not in a sense of indifference, but in a sense of there is no knowledge of this dimension of reality whatsoever.
Mm.
So it's a blind spot, as I understood it.
Okay.
I to be honest, I struggle with the idea that there cannot be a belief, but I suppose if you treat it as a blind spot, okay, that makes more sense to me.
So ignorance, maybe? How about that? Ignorance of the code?
I kind of saw it as a neutral. Like, it doesn't really matter to me. But again, if a thing doesn't matter to me, it does mean also that it's a kind of blind spot.
Oh, I agree.
Well, if it doesn't matter, it means you're still aware of it. I think this means lack of awareness altogether.
But
the unknown in Rumsfeldian terms.
Yeah, this could be playing around with words and philosophy and kind of like ideas, but like if something doesn't matter, it doesn't exist for me, I don't know.
Well, if it doesn't matter, it exists. It just doesn't matter to you. Whereas zero is a non-value. It's basically one is a positive value, minus one is a negative value. Zero is a non-value in this case. And the non-value, I think, denotes... I think blind spot is an okay way to put it. Because also, if the reality is either one or minus one, the dimensions of reality are either one or minus one, it means that it either is there or not there. And if it's not there, you can't have a positive value about it because it's not there. It doesn't...
Very
existential. It's just a bit too much. Yeah.
Struggle. Like, I'm really struggling seeing reality.
I had some difficulty too, but at least I have a little better understanding hearing from you two about what the zero might mean. So it's not, I don't think it's, I'm not sure I need to be convinced one way or the other, but it certainly adds a little more color and dimension to it for me now than what it was before. So you two have helped me. This is good.
I mean, it's not that important, and it's a bit like
Zeno's paradox. No, it's a very small point, actually. Yeah.
Where how do you learn if you don't know, or if you know, why do you need to learn, essentially?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you do see in organizations, whether you want to call it blind spot or ignorance or maybe even indifference, you do see these kinds of range of things, at least I've seen in my organizational experience, that those are issues, right? But you can have all these rules and people become ignorant of them people are not aware of them. And so there's this big challenge of communicating. And so he's not really addressing that. And I agree it's a secondary point, but it certainly clears up the confusion I had, or at least makes it a little clearer about how you could have the minus one and one and then this, the zero state. So there's something there. It's not germane or really relevant to the conclusions of the article, though.
Okay. So the next point is, two things to it. One is that it explains the role of individuals, which is that individuals modify their beliefs to conform with the organizational memory over time through socialization. If there is a positive value within organizational memory in relation to the reality. And a sub dimension of that is that changes on several dimensions of these beliefs are independent from one another. So if individuals begin conforming to what's in organizational memory in three different areas, it essentially means that not only are those changes interdependent, so there's no correlation there. There's no relation there. There may be a correlation, but there's no relation. But it also means that it will not affect any of the other areas of their knowledge, which is... I think naive. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing when I saw the independence thing, and then I had to go back and say, okay, it's a simple model. Okay. So even though maybe not valid, you can have a simple model that leaves out that level of abstraction, not necessarily abstraction. That's not the right way to say it. That level of sophistication, it still may have some things that are worth considering. So the other thing I thought was interesting, I did think it brings up this interesting point that is very useful to just think about, and that there's this idea that he assigns a probability for the effectiveness of the socialization. You know, so you could imagine a case where maybe the probability is one, where somebody comes in and they're a blank slate, or they're very naive, or they're really ready to immediately to accept the organizational memory, to use your term, Demetrius. And then you might have somebody who is at the opposite end of a, he doesn't say whether there's a, what values are. And so I assume it's a continuous spectrum of probability. So you might have somebody in, bring somebody in who's very skeptical about organizational memory and is harder to convince and takes longer to socialize, which he talks about later. He doesn't really address it here, but he talks later about that in the model. So I thought that was an interesting level of sophistication to the model.
Basically that probability of this socialization reflects some kind of as of yet hidden properties of individuals.
Yes.
I think. Yeah, yes. So it's individual centered. It's not to do with how efficient the socialization process is. It's more to do with how good of a learner or how much knowledge a person coming in has.
Right.
Okay. And the final variable in this model, the final feature, is basically the other side of this coin. It's to do with how organizational memory reacts to individuals learning right. within it.
Right. So the reciprocal and, or the reverse. Yeah.
Yeah. And there it's basically if an individual is or a group of individuals have expert power, essentially, then the organizational memory will change to that representation of reality.
Yeah, and it leaves out that whole process of how that might occur, but still it's good that he's got the learning or this that process going in both directions.
And it's, again, independent at different levels. So
right.
Yeah, that kind of sounds more realistic, I think, because organizations are not cognitively analogous to individuals. So no. Changes in certain parts may as well not have an impact on changes in other parts, although there is a whole school of thought about how organizations are nested and all of that. But this is kind of more plausible than if you're as an individual learning in or changing in a couple of areas and remaining absolutely static in others. That seems a bit strange.
Right.
And the final aspect of this is that the model is assumed to begin working from a blank slate, where you have organizations starting from zero, individuals starting from zero as well, and then carrying forward in kind of figuring out what the reality may be. And it's important to note that when they arrive at this equilibrium, when individuals are fully in sync with the organization, with the organizational memory, whatever they come up with about reality doesn't necessarily have to be correct. They may end up being absolutely wrong about each aspect, about each dimension of this unchanging reality, but it's okay because they still would have kind of learned within the organization. The organizational memory would become harmonious with individual knowledges and memories, and that's kind of where the model goes in terms of being within the organization.
And once again, while I think that's incredibly unrealistic, that's not the purpose of the model. It's to show to look at where equilibrium is established and what some of the factors are that affect the equilibriums. Again, it doesn't have to be realistic if you're just trying to show, okay, we're at this neutral state. And you can make the argument, okay, the neutral state is just what everybody knows already, and then we move forward in time from that. So, all right, I accept that.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of this is to do this experiment to show whether quick learning is better for the amount of knowledge gained into this memory of the organization. Right. Because remember that organizations store knowledge and in their memory. Right. And kind of the thesis is that if you have quick learning individuals within the company and they just go and quickly learn stuff, then the memory will, by this model, adjust to what they know. So yes. He says that quick learning is actually not very good in terms of getting more knowledge.
So let me get one thing straight, because I'm a bit confused. There's also the assumption that individuals stay in the organizations.
So he does two iterations, the closed model where nothing changes, and then he does an open model where individuals can come and go.
True.
So yes, within the
thank you, I think this is an important point. I mean, yes. I know that I have the tendency to read these kind of works and to picture what it means in reality. And this is one of the reasons why, I'm very honest, for me it was a bit of a struggle, this one. So I was thinking about this idea of members that stay.
No, that's an important aspect, and I kind of missed out on that. So thank you. Yeah, within the closed model, essentially, quick learning is bad because you accumulate less knowledge. Slow learning is better because you manage to accumulate more knowledge about the reality. And he kind of ends there. Then he does the open model that Miranda mentioned, And in the open model, there's labor turnover. There's not any technological turnover or anything like that, but basically people can come and go and everything else remains the same. And there he shows that these negative effects of learning quickly can actually be offset by labor turnover, because the people who will be coming into the organization to replace the ones who are leaving will be bringing not only different levels of knowledge, but also different dimensions. And that will kind of introduce new stuff into the organization. And there's a bunch of graphs that kind of demonstrate this based on various statistics that they kind of input into this model and run through the analytics. Again, making a whole bunch of assumptions along the way, such as that recruits coming into the organization would be less knowledgeable than existing members. And at the end of that, he shows a comparison between an organization in an open system with turnover and without turnover.
Right.
And the one without turnover, just basically he writes, as a result, after an initial period of increasing accuracy, the knowledge of the code, which is organizational memory, and individuals is systematically degraded through changes in reality, which is what we alluded to, that
right.
you basically get trapped in doing the same thing when the rest of the world sort of moves on and leaves you behind. And,
yeah, and you're talking about figure four, I think.
And that's kind of the thing about, I think, I mean, do add if I miss something, but that's the thing about learning within organizations and the importance of rotating individuals in order to keep the organizational memory relevant with the reality or representation of thereof.
I don't know. I have a number of skeptical points, let's put it that way. And I do admit I'm struggling with this work and it doesn't really belong to my way of seeing these topics. But I think one important thing is this idea of employee retention, because I don't know, I see these people maybe leaving an organization and founding their own business, or I see and maybe becoming a potential competitor. I think that there are a lot of things that aren't really included in this simplified view of the world.
Well, in this world, there is only one organization.
Yeah, so. that is already an issue for me.
What I struggle to understand is why this matters, essentially, in a way that because reality is unchanging and the only thing that's changing is the beliefs
right.
about what it may or may not be. Individuals coming in to the organization, individuals leaving, they don't accumulate knowledge. They accumulate differing beliefs or homogeneous beliefs about the reality.
Right.
So I struggle to understand how this manages to accumulate knowledge in a way that he says it does, because I guess maybe it's that it's about the number of different dimensions of this reality that an organization can catalog that kind of counts as accumulation of knowledge. And in this way, okay, it makes sense. So you get to have some rotation and you get to have some internal exploration and you can catalog as many of these different angles of this reality. But there in terms of knowledge having any kind of a variation within it, so different types of knowledge, not different kinds as in here, but different types or even different tokens of knowledge, this is completely omitted. Knowledge is this
right,
binary thing that either
yes.
there or not there,
right?
And you collect them all or not, essentially, until time runs out when you have the space to have new inputs. And that's really hard to, I agree with you, Miranda, that's very hard to get your head around if you're trying to visualize any of this empirically, but it isn't empirical, and
no, it's not meant to be.
No, it's not.
Okay.
And that concludes part 1 of episode 19. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more, get the link to the text, and look at supplementary readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations. Also, make sure to tell your friends, students, and colleagues about us so that they too can enjoy these wonderful works of classic management. Please join us next week as we conclude our discussion of Exploration and Exploitation in Organizational Learning by James Marsh here on Talking About Organizations.